Hello and welcome to Growing Up B2B. I'm Ed D'Elia, president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. For over 60 years, and now across two generations, we've been helping B2B companies achieve next-level growth through brand distinction, quality lead generation, and sales enablement. Growing Up B2B was created for family business leaders who are passionate about growth, legacy, and making a lasting impact. Whether it's a multi-generational legacy or multiple family members working together, there's something truly magical about blending business with family. And we want to celebrate that right here on Growing Up B2B. So be sure to stick around to the end of the show and find out how you can be our next guest. Okay, let's get into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Growing Up B2B. I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, second generation president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. Today's guest brings a perspective we do not often get on this show. Someone who was not born into the family business, but who has spent much of his professional career inside them. Today, I'm joined by Paul Morris. Paul has held senior leadership roles across multiple family-governed B2B organizations, particularly in the packaging and specialty manufacturing space. Over the course of his career, he has operated at the intersection of family, ownership, and professional management, often as a trusted executive brought in to help businesses grow, stabilize, or evolve. Today, through his firm Cadre Associates, Paul frequently supports international companies looking to expand, professionalize, or enter the U.S. market. This conversation is about what family businesses look like from the inside when you are not part of the family. What works, what breaks, and what family owners often do not realize about how their businesses are experienced by the leaders they bring in from the outside. Paul, welcome to Growing Up B2B.
Thanks, Ed. Great to be here with you. Thanks for inviting me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Same here. As I mentioned, we don't often get this perspective, so I think this is going to be really interesting.
Maybe the first and last episode.
hopefully not, but let's get into it. So you have spent your career inside, just about your entire career, but maybe not all, inside family-governed B2B companies without being part of the family. Yeah. What would you say drew you into that kind of an environment to begin with?
Well, I'll say there was no conscious decision to work in family companies, right? But that just evolves. Although there were times during my career that I made decisions to leave one entity and move to another or was recruited to an opportunity. But it's interesting because companies are started and they're not normally not unless, they're the pack things that happen today. They start with some sort of family, some individual, and then what evolves from there is just the storyline of the company. Mm-hmm. So I've worked for Fortune 100 companies and private equity companies. Most of those, the genesis was a family business. Mm-hmm. Quite often could be 50 or 100 years prior. But how I got into the packaging business and briefly, talk about family for me, I'm the youngest of three, and my dad was finance person. My mother, older brother, and older sister were artists, still are. My folks have passed. But so I grew up in this household of discipline of finance and then the creativity. And I kind of straddled both worlds. So when I went off to study, interests that I had were involved in creative. So I studied advertising and graphic arts and then printing. I ended up getting a degree in printing technology. So I kind of call myself a bullshit artist, right? I understand the creative side, but I try to execute on the functional business side of things. And my first job out of school was in the packaging business, and I spent the next 40 years enjoying it. Everything's in a package, and it's just been a wonderful journey. And whether it's a corporate company or a family company, it all comes down to people. So,
absolutely. And certainly in the greater packaging industry, you do see your fair share of family-governed businesses that are passed down or into, in some cases, their fourth, fifth, sixth. We've even spoken to a gentleman in the seventh generation of his family's printing business. So not uncommon to see that generational pass off, maybe because of much like yourself, you didn't fall too far from, two trees. You kind of fell in the middle.
In between. But, so my first job out of school was for a family-owned business, which you've interviewed the third generation of that. But so I was home on summer break. I was going to graduate the next semester. And one of my professors set up an interview, and I go and, you know, got my suit and tie, and I'm in the lobby, and in the lobby is a beautiful portrait oil painting of the founder, the first generation. I was going to interview with the president, who is the second generation. And it just struck me that day of like how he played homage to his dad. His dad had already passed. He mm-hmm. inherited the business. He was working in it, but inherited the business. You know, you have a similar experience too, that there's plans, but life changes all the time. And there was something special about that. And then I went and I had the interview, and I had a bunch of other offers, and I ended up taking that job. And then I ended up, at that time, he's 5, maybe 10 years younger than me, who's running the business now as a third generation. And I've stayed in touch with him and see what he's done with the business. It's remarkable to see how that has continued on, not without a lot of challenges and stress and other things, but it's really a tribute to people keeping it together. And other times people can't, or they don't want to either,
sure.
You know,
sure. So when you step in to a family-owned enterprise as an executive, and you've stepped into several across your career, you referenced the first, but right. That was the first of many more to come. As you've evolved as an executive and as one that does come into these businesses oftentimes to help them in some material way, what's the first dynamic that you look for or try to understand before you start to make any decisions?
Yeah. Yeah. So you think about, you know, how you arrive at accepting a position, you know, or you've finished one assignment and you're looking for another, or you're currently engaged in something and you get recruited. And one of them for me was a situation where I was approached, and it's a family business started by an individual who created one company. And then there was an affiliate company, and he has two children, and the two children are involved in the business. And there was son-in-laws and daughter-in-laws and other things. Strong, healthy businesses, well-regarded in their respective industries, and somebody wanted to step aside in a leadership position. So I was recruited for that, and I went, and I knew of these companies already, but I went to speak with them, and I was, my interview day, I probably spent 6 hours there meeting with the founder, his wife, the two siblings, both of their spouses were in the meeting with all these people in addition to some other managers in HR. So I was interviewed by the family, but I got to meet all these people, and they were all cordial, asking pointed and appropriate business questions, but there were also some personal anecdotes shared and, you know, things that we have in common. And then, of course, my job is to find out what do you want me to do? And what is the status of the company? And everyone is forthcoming, but you can't learn everything in a 6-hour day of interviews or subsequent. So in that particular situation, I accepted the opportunity and I get there. And first thing is you look at all the, you know, the tangible, the metrics, the numbers, the P&L, the customers, the sales. And so what data do you have? How are you running your business? What do you want to do? Where do you want to go? But then along with that, you look at being observational of the behaviors, the interaction, because every business has a culture. And family businesses have a more unique culture, I would say. You know, when you're growing up, you know, and you have the lower bunk bed and your brother has the upper bunk bed, but now you're the president and he's VP of ops or whatever. There's these dynamics that you don't understand. And I would say it was very important for me to understand the unspoken hierarchies, mm-hmm. power plays, the stronger personalities. Some people are more assertive. We all have strengths and weaknesses. And then what the founding generation or the more senior generation, their engagement with the business. In this particular situation, the individual was, you know, executive chairman, but he came into the office at least once a week. And he always stopped in my office. He reminded me of my dad. He had like newspaper clippings and would drop it on my desk. And it was wonderful. But then you had to say, okay, the chairman asked me about this. The president asked me about that, the VP, and they're not aligned. So I have a certain amount of authority and power or responsibility. How do I manage that? And you have to set up personal boundaries that fit within your responsibilities in your job. I mean, it happens in any organization. If you're a publicly traded company or, you know, private equity, that there's personnel dynamics, but I found that they're more acute in a family business, higher highs and lower lows, maybe. And then if there's, say, misbehavior, but if there's certain things that maybe you might be a little more quick to be corrective with an employee, if it's a family member, you need to be a little more guarded in how you handle that situation, because there's reverberations. So it's really like setting up boundaries. And what I have found is you have to be consistent in your communication and your behavior. And we all, there's certain people that we enjoy more or get along with more or have more in common. But when you're in a family business, really, I found it has to be a very even-tempered relationship. So
I think what you're offering is huge insight and perspective, because I know of at least two CEOs brought in from the outside, two family-governed businesses. Both had a, I'll just say, an unexpected exit. And in both cases, they had the metrics cold. The numbers all looked right, and hence their surprise. But what I think they missed in the look back was the human dynamics at play. They didn't quite get that, and they didn't see that, hence they didn't see it coming. And in both cases, they could say, "What, we grew the company X percent. This is up. The numbers were all up." Yeah, but there was something on the human side that didn't align. And needless to say, they were out of that opportunity. Both cases, very similar.
Perfect example, because you can be executing and delivering on what you've been asked to do, meeting your budget, cutting costs, opening new markets. But if somehow you've, the word might be threatened an individual, they don't feel uncomfortable that who is this outsider that's, you know, who moved my cheese or whatever. That is the really the most difficult part of it, is you have to decide, am I going to do the right thing or am I going to play into it? And it's a very fine line, because if you start getting involved in it, you get sucked into those interpersonal dynamics. And I've found that you're, no matter what you do and who you align with, you're still not part of the family. And they're going to circle the wagons. And you're outside. And that can be okay, because you say, I'm here, I did my job, I'm leaving with my head held high. Because I'm not looking to get in, or are you there entering to displace somebody? That's not going to happen. That's going to come from the chairman or whomever, to say this son is out and this son or daughter is in. So it's, I mean, you could spin this off and do, like, you know, like a Real Housewives type of show.
Probably so. But it's not uncommon for situations, and you've been in some of them, where a family governed business will say, all right, we need some outside professional leadership, right? For various reasons. It could be that the rising generation doesn't want to lead, or they don't have the skills and capabilities to lead, or for some other reason. But they'll say, you know, okay, so we need to bring in some professional leadership, either a president role or a CEO role. So in your experience, Paul, what do they usually mean when they say that? And where does reality possibly differ? When they say, hey, we want professional leadership, what are they really trying to say?
Yeah. You know, what is that definition? And then there's a constant evolution of what that conversation and definition is. It's very rewarding, but it's a precarious situation that you enter into those family dynamics, because there is something about family businesses. They're growing. And what do they need? They need funding to continue that growth, or get the new technology, or enter a new market. Well, bank loans to privately held companies, you know, they have to put a second mortgage on their house, or they have to do other things. So it's very personal to them. It's not only factual as far as the spreadsheets and the numbers and the decisions, but it's personal. So when they're feeling that and they say, this is what we're going to do, we want to enter into this market, or we want to reduce our reliance on our China supply chain. Okay. So then you do that work to show them, well, this is what we need to do to meet those goals. And there's reluctance, or we can't do that, or why is it going to take so long, or how come it's going to cost so much money? And then I have found at times that people feel either left out or threatened, and a healthy disagreement and discourse is welcome. But at times then you're to look over your shoulder and is like, am I going to be sabotaged? And then someone can say, see, I told you so. So it's, I would say constantly, it's not that you're suspicious, but you just have to be aware of behaviors and words that are spoken. Look at body language. Look at how people follow up. They say they're going to do something, but are those actions behind it? And that's what I found. There's this aspirational thing, or it's survival, right? We need to survive. We need to fire people. We need to reorganize. And then it's like, okay, well, we can reduce headcount here. And they're like, oh no, you know, we love Mary. She's been with us for 18 years. And it's like, okay, but if you're going to pay that person, and I respect that, you know, not just being cold-blooded, but you have to make difficult decisions. I have had that where I've been brought in and have to do a restructuring. And I have found certain employees beneficial, productive. And then I'm told from the others to say, oh no, get rid of them. And I'm like, go to HR and you look in their files. And it's like, well, this person's been here and you've given them good reviews and they've gotten raises. There's no negative performance. I can't fire them. I've got to put them on a plan, and you know, it's got to be done legally. And then you find out it's an emotional thing. And why? I don't know that they'll ever disclose that. And you don't want to get into, well, you know, somebody dated, somebody kissed somebody at the Christmas party. I mean, there's all these little things. So it works both ways as far as I've been the hired gun, asked to come in and do the dirty work that they did not want to do. And then you have to say, I agree with that decision. Or at times I've had to say, I don't agree, or I'm indifferent to the decision, but there's steps you have to take before you make this decision, because there could be legal ramifications.
And that's all good advice and guidance from a professional leader. They have to know the risks, you know, and the upside and the downside to decision making, and then proceed accordingly. So given, and this I think leads into my next question, you've obviously, you know, definitely worked with family governed businesses at different stages. You know, some were in growth mode, some were in distress, and some were kind of preparing for an exit, albeit there is not a next generation to take the helm, and the company has elected it's time to sell this asset and move on. So talk about that for a minute, Paul. How does the governing family's involvement change when, say, the pressure stakes are higher, whether in a high growth mode or distress mode or prepping for exit mode, all again have different challenges, different pressures? How does that dynamic look from your perspective when you're involved in those situations?
Yeah. So thinking back on one family company that was extremely successful, dad had founded it, grew the business exponentially, just in the right place at the right time. And an individual who took risks, made decisions, they all didn't pay off, but most of them did. A son and daughter were in the business, and both capable, but not the next, really weren't able, even interested in taking over the torch, but they were very comfortable, very comfortable in their compensation and their roles, and did good jobs. So the company did a private equity, came in, invested, and you know, handsomely rewarded, invested in the company, grew the business. That individual stayed on with an agreement, you know, quite often if they don't want to exit right away, and there's a benefit to keeping somebody on the business for the goodwill and the contacts and an earn out, right? We'll give you X amount of dollars today, and then you can earn X plus if you deliver these things over the next 3 to 5 years. So it was a 5-year horizon, and then there was another transaction, and then the individual left the company, but the two children were still involved in different parts of the business. And it was like, it was just really awkward. Then they just kind of let go of the wheel, You know, like I'm here and, you know, I've got money. And it was just like almost being dared to take action on them. And I knew these people and I like them personally. And previously they had been performers, but kind of just, you know, the pot of gold had come. So it again, it really depends when the founder was the driving force. And I don't know that he really wanted to let go of the business, but the second offer was just too good to refuse. And things are timing. And since in the market, the second company that bought it, when I got there, then it became distress private equity. And then that lasted way too long. I think ultimately they held on to it for like 8 years before it got flipped. And then it got flipped into another consortium of companies. Mm-hmm. And so the founder did the right thing from a timing and financials when he made those decisions. But being involved in that and in the wake, the aftermath of it was quite challenging. Mm. So ultimately, the other family members left the business, and then it was just, you know, how do we survive? Because quite often, goodwill is diminished in a transaction. The trust, being able to pick up the phone and call the CEO on a Saturday and say, I really need this next week, that type of thing, that gets lost. When the company's being run by a matrix organization in a remote headquarter, or if it's being run by a, you know, private equity company, not 100%, but quite often, you know, their discipline is we're here to make money. We have a plan. We have an exit strategy. They're not looking to grow the business for 20 years. So
yeah. It's ironic. The very things that make a family-governed B2B organization attractive to private equity or other capital or other investors are sometimes the very thing that often, unfortunately, is lost Yes. in the transaction if they're not careful, because they love this idea of the continuity, of the longevity, of the stability, you know, all the things that a well-run family-governed B2B company often brings to the table, the deep personal relationships with customers, with suppliers, with key personnel, you know, all of that, you know, if they're not careful, can be unfortunately erased very yeah. quickly. And once it is, you know, it's hard to win that trust back, you know, so it's a delicate balance that they must strike usually. But typically, I think the PE world is getting a little bit more tuned into that. Especially at the tier one, when they're, you know, making that first acquisition in a certain industry or a certain company type, that let's not pull too many levers too fast, right? Mm-hmm. We bought a good asset. Let's make sure we take care of it.
No, it's so two things on that. One company that I work with, privately held, fantastic company. Just the leadership was unbelievable to the point today a NYU professor is going to write a book. Why was this company so successful? Printing company in the packaging business. Why were they so successful? Because of the culture, without a doubt. And you could be in a very difficult business environment, but it felt like a family. It felt like a team. The company was sold to a larger publicly traded company, and I was mid-level management sales, and it was nice in the beginning. There was investment, there was, you know, other things, but what we boiled it down to, we went from being a speedboat to being an aircraft carrier. Mm-hmm. Still had capabilities, had expanded capabilities, didn't have the response. The culture changed. It got the value of the company was diluted. And when I say value, it was that mojo. And the other side of that is calling on, you know, you're doing work with a company, a founder, right? And they have this business and they hit it and it's great and they get bought out. So I don't know. I know I'm not supposed to mention companies, but just the ubiquitous P&G, right? Procter & Gamble, mm-hmm. phenomenal company. I've done business with them 30 some odd years. I was just out there last week. In the past, they would buy somebody and then, you know, we'd call it, they'd proctorize it. What would they do? Well, they're brilliant finance, they're engineers, they're scientists, but they would go in and say, oh, we can buy this cheaper. And why do you do this way? And we're going to move out of this garage that you're working in. And that's all appropriate if there's, you know, you're going to grow the business. But so much of that, they destroyed the ethos of it. Now, P&G Ventures, when they're buying things, and in the beauty space, it's like Tula and First Aid Beauty and Pharmacy, and they're leaving those things alone. This huge, well, I don't know, whatever they are, $50 billion conglomerate has learned that they've spent good valuation dollars and then they've destroyed the brands. And now they're stepping back, bringing in the right people in the right levels, but they're not overtaking the company. Mm-hmm. And then these companies can grow.
Yeah.
Or at least succeed. Or if nothing else, they're growing because they're expanding distribution. So it's really about, I mean, I can have intellectual property, I can have the best equipment, whatever it is, but people deal with people. Right. If you trust me, if you respect me, you'll come back. Mm-hmm. And when that gets lost, when people disappear without mentoring, right? So if a founder of a privately held company is there, they're the face of the brand, but they want to cash out. Mm-hmm. Has the acquirer brought in somebody who's going to take that leadership role, right? Like things mm-hmm. like that I've done. And what you have to do is try to get as much of that, you know, as I said, mojo, ethos, whatever you want to call it, because that's what drew your customers to that business. That's why that relationship is there. If you kill that, you just slowly see people disappearing, and those repeat orders or those new business relationships, they don't occur because you become cold and sterile, and it's not fun either.
It's not fun. There was a brother had built up a very large and exited a large company in the construction space, and he had a long-standing employee with him. Incredible. She was just a remarkable executive. And he once asked her, he said, you know, you could walk out this door and probably make double what you're making here, you know, tomorrow. And she said, yeah, I could. But you know what? I'd miss the action. And that's why she stayed. She could make a lot more money, but she knew I wouldn't enjoy it. I wouldn't have fun. And, you know, when you think about the amount of times we spend engaged in our business lives, it's considerable. It better darn well be rewarding and fun, or as fun as we can make it, right?
It is. And I look back on those things too, where I just, you know, you're in a foxhole together with somebody, difficult situations, but it was that camaraderie and working together that you supported each other. And then all the way on the other end are the hired guns, right? Mm-hmm. I worked with someone brilliant operationally. He was, you know, senior VP of operations for very big companies. But he was a former Army Ranger. He came in, he was there on a mission, and it was, you know, blood. Didn't care. There was no emotion. Operationally fantastic. Ultimately, he had to keep moving on because after he did what he had to do, they had to get somebody else in there to rebuild. You know, he could come in and clean house and do whatever. And things that had to be done. He was not afraid of making those difficult decisions. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's warranted, but you know, you can ask somebody to leave with a sledgehammer or a feather, I guess. Yeah.
True. Yeah. Something you said earlier, I wanted to get back to, where you've referenced a couple of companies where you've seen multiple generations involved in leadership. So as an outsider looking in, where do you see the most tension showing up typically between generations, where there is that, you know, next generation coming into the business, or maybe there's that some level of transition of power, or they're stepping up into a leadership role as the next generation, maybe not necessarily the next in line to lead, but certainly
right.
Part of that generational progression. So when you see, talk about that for a moment. What do you see when you see that?
You mean like the baton going from first to second or second to third?
Or that second or third stepping into the business, or maybe stepping into a leadership role in the business for the first time. Where do you see some of the tension points?
There's no one answer there, but I would say it really comes down to the personalities and the willingness to allow. It's like whoever's in leadership today, hey, you have to have a succession plan, right? Even if you want to stay on, that you're always going to have an office in the building and you come in once a week or whatever. That's wonderful. But knowing when to relinquish or to delegate and allow that next group to have that experience. You don't want them to make mistakes to put the company out of business. Mm-hmm. But you can't oversee every decision that they make, because mm-hmm. then they're not emerging. So I would say that that's something where, is it continuing on a successful business as opposed to a business that's at a crossroads where, hey, we used to do this and AI has wiped this out, or, we made everything in the US and now we have competition from offshore. So I would say it's twofold. Again, like I said, it's the data, those tangible things versus the soft things about the personalities, the skill set. Mm-hmm. And, ego is a word. Ego isn't necessarily negative. I mean, there's the shadow and light side of everything. And ego mm-hmm. is taking control or putting your imprint on things. When it becomes selfish or fearful, that's a challenge. So I would say that in that case, when you're looking to get the next generation engaged, the one that's handing off, they have to be ready to let go. It's just like, my daughter's going out on dates. I'd be waiting in the fall asleep on the living room couch. Wait, you have to let them live their lives. That's one nuance. The other one is you're basically taking your business, which is another child, and entrusting it with someone else in the family, and you have to curtail the quick response. I mean, if something is inappropriate or just bad decision, you have to take action, but you have to let people learn.
Yeah. And I would say a testament to this program, and maybe not surprising in the look back, is just about every guest that's speaking on behalf of being in a family business, maybe the second, third, fourth generation, every single one of them, including myself, we had early and often exposure and involvement to the business at, in some cases, a ridiculously young age. I have childhood memories when I was like 4 or 5 years old, being at the office, not uncommon from some of our other guests. And
yeah.
I would even be inclined to argue that the reason that our guests are that way is because those that didn't have that early often exposure maybe didn't make it to the next generation.
No, but I mean, you're more of a services business, but I know many people who were there and they were packing boxes at the end of the line, sweeping the floor, doing the dishes in a restaurant, whatever it is, learn the business from the ground up. And I think that's just so valuable, because when you go into leadership roles, you have respect for the people that are doing those jobs today. And your receptionist, your custodian, everyone else, they're important employees and they are part of the culture. And I think it's very helpful if that can happen.
Yeah,
some people don't do, they're not involved in the business, and then they go and they get their Harvard MBA and then, they want to get involved in the family business, or the family wants to bring them in. And at times that's a disconnect. Although having experience outside the family in other companies where you're just an employee, that's also valuable too.
100%.
You know,
100%. I think that's very true. So this question is one that I've been wanting to ask you. If you look back, and you've been brought in many times, and oftentimes by family-governed business, what's one lesson that you wish family business owners understood or were clear on before bringing in outside leadership? What are some things that they should be thinking about or knowing before they even take that step?
Yeah, I would say really like to try to have empathy, right? Let's reverse roles, you know, for however you came to this decision to say that we can't do it, we don't want to do it, we don't have the skill set, we need a fresh, you know, we're so much in our tunnel that we need a fresh set of eyes, or whatever the reason that they believe they need external help. And I would say often that doesn't really happen in those initial interviews or meetings or whatever. It's kind of task oriented. And then you see if you can work with that person. But I think the families that are looking to bring in someone from the outside, do your best to say, okay, I'm Paul Morris and I'm joining this family business. What does Paul Morris think about what he's entering? And at least be willing to, it would be helpful if somebody said to me, you know, I want you to, I'm going to listen to you if you disagree with me. Just things where it is just in any relationship, right? I'm married for 40 years. You have these times where you're like, you got to respond, don't react, right? Count to 10. But you have to have boundaries, but speak your truth. Ask the tough questions in a non-threatening way. So I would say when a decision is made to bring in somebody from the outside, quite often it's not the whole group agreeing. And it could be just two family, it could be the husband and wife, it could be there's second, third generation siblings, uncles, cousins. And not everyone's going to agree that we want to bring this individual on, or they're not going to agree with the individual that has been brought in. So I would say as best as possible, they have to be open to being honest and have a give and take. I use the word empathy. I think that's really so important because the spotlight's on you, right? You're the new guy.
Yeah.
You're going to, oh, we want to do this. You know, you got your 100-day plan. You got this. Things haven't turned around. And like one job I took, yeah, okay. We understood what we were doing. And then COVID hit. Well, yeah, throw the plans out the window. And that was universal, right? That's the whole planet. But there was still pressure and still questions and standing in front of the board and asking me, what are you doing about this? Holy crap. I'm doing my best. Do you have an answer? Do you have a suggestion? No. I mean, my next life or maybe in the future, I'm going to be on the board of directors, but I'm going to try to be empathetic. But to get hit with those questions, and it's like, it's on the job training, pal. I was not prepared to enter a business that imported most of its product offshore and then sold to businesses who had salons and things. So it was
interesting times.
Again, but that is, you learn a lot, right? Mm-hmm. And it was very challenging, had to lay off people and stuff, but there you can learn something in every difficult decision. And if you do it, again, with as much information as you can get, and again, speak honestly with everybody.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, the empathy point, and really, you know, kind of having an open mind to, you know, that person you're bringing to the organization. And usually a high-level person coming to the organization, it's not like you don't have options. Usually you have not one or two, but probably 10, you know? So you're making a conscious choice as much as they are to do this. And, you know, I've also seen that scenario where somebody stepped into an organization as a hired CEO or president who's not part of the family business. And they're saying, this is madness. I'm gone. I can't function in this because I've seen this happen. And usually this is where they implode. If family members can't get along outside the business, usually is a precursor that they're not going to get along very well inside the business, you know?
No,
So, and that's usually a recipe for disaster. So, you know, people ask me like, well, should I, well, do you get along? Well, somewhat. Okay. Somewhat isn't great. Somewhat sounds like you don't.
So, boy, that is it. And, you know, it's like you can't really evaluate that until you're in the pool.
Yeah,
you know, it's hard. But there's been times where you're in the pool and you're like, I'm going to drown. It makes no sense. There's no amount of life preservers. And those are dynamics where they have to solve it themselves.
Sure.
And then those are the businesses often that don't succeed. There was another company that I didn't work for, but they were in the industry, more in the publication and news information management. And a father started the business. One of the sons was in it. Number two, great job. They were like a dynamic duo at different age levels. But there was other siblings who were not involved in the business, but they all had, you know, they were getting X number of dollars per month or whatever it was. And then things got tough. And then dad died. And then the son that took over was running the business. His siblings came after him with knives, you know. It's like, well, where's my $10,000 a month or whatever? And it's like, $10,000 a month? I'm trying to keep the business afloat. And they're like blaming him. And he's like, well.
Yeah.
So, again,
yeah,
because your blood doesn't mean that,
yeah,
you know, so
absolutely,
yeah.
So, today, let's talk about where you're at today through Cadre Associates.
Yes.
You work with a number of international companies. So, if you could talk about that for a moment, how have all these past experiences you've had governing or working at an executive level in family businesses? To what extent have they shaped the way that you would advise some of the overseas companies that you're working with and advising and consulting with now?
Yeah, well, I would say that adds, and quick, what some of the things that I had done in the past, whether it was for small privately held companies, family, or ones that were larger publicly traded companies, quite often I had roles like global accounts and things. So I mentioned P&G, right? So I conquered Cincinnati and I had those relationships. Well, then I was going to Mexico and then I was going to Europe and then I was going to Singapore, P&G or L'Oreal or whomever it may be. The value of that was then I got to learn, there's a company culture, but when you're at P&G Cincinnati versus P&G Shanghai, then you're learning the culture of China, right? So that was fascinating. So I learned so much about that. Not a master, but some awareness because as an American, as a native New Yorker, I have my life experience and my view on the world. But I've been most places, not everywhere, but I've been most places and doing that, mostly doing business, some vacations. But that's another part of the culture, right? So then now I'm two offshore companies, one from Colombia in South America, which is a second generation company that came from Europe, and they've got three different businesses and they're successful. And they've asked me to help them develop their presence in North America. And again, this is not a blanket generalization, but Latin Americans are, in my experience, more familial, you know. Multiple generations live in the household, and just the way they have their last names, it's Julio Hernandez Mayeras, that, you know, and it's my mother's name in the town, as opposed to a German company and or something else where there's, it's just a cultural thing. Ultimately, it boils down to individuals, but you have to understand where they're coming from. I'm not going to undo their heritage and their culture, but that's part of my job is to tell them, this is the United States and this is the stuff that's going on here. You have a good product. You have a good company. These are the dynamics that, you know, this is the pool that you want to jump into. I believe there's an opportunity. And then they'll say, well, why did this happen? Or, hey, this is great. We didn't expect this. Another company is a Vietnamese company, which is second generation. And the young man who's looking to grow the U.S. business had basically said to me, I mean, I have my life experience professionally, but after we had lunch one day, he came back to me and said, I'd like you to, you know, work with me on this. And it's like, okay, what's the scope? And he basically said, I'd like you to be my father in the United States. I just need somebody that I can go to, you know, not that he diminished his relationship with his dad, but it's also, he has to be independent, but there is something about going to someone who's been through the mill, has gotten the cuts and bruises, as well as somebody who knows the market that he's challenged with growing. So it's cultural. And then, but again, you know, I keep going back to the whole, you know, it's the personalities. And if people can be authentic and vulnerable, raise your hand and say, I don't know the answer. I don't know. Let's work on it together, or fire me, or let's decide to pivot to something else. There's a lot of fear, and you know, you don't want to seem inept or incapable. I mean, myself included, but I've found that trying to gloss something over that pops up in the, you can run, but you can't hide, you know?
Very true. Very true. Well, last question for you today. If any of our listeners wanted to connect with you directly or learn more about your work at Cadre Associates, what's the best way for them to do so?
Well, thank you. That's very nice. I would say just reach out to me on LinkedIn. And I have, you know, connect with me there, or paul@cadreassociates.com would be a way. And I'd love to hear from you and see if I can help you. Or the other thing I do is, because I've traveled so much and work with big companies who have so many employees who go everywhere else, I have a big network. So quite often I get a phone call and all I'm doing is just connecting to people and wishing them well, which is great because I'm also calling people. Do you know somebody? So it's nice to help each other out. And I thank you. And our relationship for however long, I don't know, 15, 20 years we've known each other, right?
Something like that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Time flies.
It does fly. Well, thank you so much, Paul.
My pleasure.
This has been valuable, refreshing. And I think your perspective has been incredibly genuine, too. Because you've really helped shine a light on some of the realities of the family-governed business, but from the inside out. And you've done so without judgment, with a lot of clarity, and you know, with some real grounded experience that only comes from living it, as you have so many times across your career. So I think these insights are especially important for any family leaders who are, you know, want to grow, who are open to bringing in some outside leadership to do so, but ultimately don't want to lose trust or culture, all the things that got them to that inflection point along the way.
Yeah.
Again, we've been speaking with Paul Morris of Cadre Associates, and I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and this has been another episode of Growing Up B2B. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Ed.
Hey, thanks so much for tuning into Growing Up B2B. To explore more episodes and insights, visit podcast.delianet.com. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating or review on your podcast platform of choice. Having worked with hundreds of family-led businesses across my career, and being a second-generation leader myself, I'm on a mission to help every family business I meet achieve next-level growth for their organization. So feel free also to connect with me on LinkedIn and let's support each other. You can also find out more about my company at DeliaNet.com. Again, I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and thanks so much for joining us today. Take care.